From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The use of steroids in Major League Baseball was widespread. The response by baseball was slow to develop and was initially ineffective.
Baseball's Hall of Shame. Over 90 players are named, including some of the game's biggest superstars. We'll talk with sports writer Dave Zirin about absolving the owners. And as hundreds of thousands of high school students follow their role model's example, we'll talk with a mother whose son died of steroid abuse. Barry Bonds was his idol. Then the final Democratic presidential debate of the year is held in Iowa. We'll play highlights. And New Jersey abolishes the death penalty, the first state to do so in decades. We'll speak with a New Jerseyan who lost his daughter to murder. Despite that, he's campaigned against the death penalty for years. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Negotiators at a major global climate summit in Bali say they're close to reaching a compromise agreement. Talks have stalled this week over the Bush administration's rejection of several key provisions, including a pledge to cut emissions levels up to 40% by 2020. Observers expect a weak compromise deal if White House objections stand. The final day of talks follows increasing criticism of the U.S. On Thursday, Nobel Peace Laureate Al Gore drew wide applause from the Bali conference when he called the Bush administration the main obstacle to an agreement.
I am going to speak an inconvenient truth. My own country, the United States, is principally responsible for obstructing progress here in Bali. And it really is up to you. I don't know how to tell you how you can find the grace to navigate around this enormous obstacle, this elephant in the room that I've just been undiplomatic enough to name.
European Union nations have vowed to boycott a U.S.-backed climate summit in Hawaii next month over the Bush administration's stance. The Honolulu Gathering of Industrialized Nations is part of a process organized by the White House to sidestep the U.N. Portugal Environmental Minister Humberto Rosa said the meeting would be pointless if the Bali talks fail.
If we would have a failure in Bali, it would be meaningless to have the major economies meeting, which has been agreed that is to look also to what happened to the Bali roadmap. So without a roadmap and without a destination, the Commission said, it would be senseless.
The Bali meeting is convening to reach a new deal to succeed the Kyoto Protocol. The U.S. is the only industrialized nation to reject Kyoto, which requires a modest 5% reduction below 1990 levels by the year 2012. The Bush administration has also rejected proposals that would provide financial support to poorer countries most affected by climate change. Professor Richard Odingo of the Nobel Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says the stance could have devastating effects for Africa.
If you look at the temperature projections, nobody can stand a temperature increase of 5 degrees centigrade, which we are projecting. And when they arrive, the future will be so uncomfortable. People will be running away from Africa. And the European powers, for example, they don't want Africans to go to Europe now to look for jobs. But this will happen more and more. We'll have environmental refugees.
As the Bush administration continues to reject binding pollution cuts, new figures show this year has been one of the warmest on record. A British study says 2007 was the second warmest ever in the Northern Hemisphere. The 11 warmest years on record have all occurred within the last 13 years. On Capitol Hill, the Senate approved a new energy bill without key provisions opposed by the Bush administration and major corporations. Republicans had threatened a presidential veto over measures including $21 billion in taxes on the oil and gas industry and requiring utility companies to draw 15% of their power from renewable sources by the year 2020. In a major victory for those companies, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid introduced a new version of the bill, omitting the corporate tax package. In other news from Washington, the House has approved an intelligence bill barring the CIA from using harsh methods, including waterboarding and mock executions while interrogating prisoners. The White House has threatened a veto. The measure now goes to the Senate. The Senate Judiciary Committee has passed a contempt citation against White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton and former White House aide Karl Rove. Bolton and Rove have refused congressional subpoenas for testimony and documents in the firing of federal prosecutors. The contempt vote will go before the full Senate. In Somalia, the Ethiopian government is denying involvement in a deadly attack on civilians in the capital, Mogadishu. At least 17 people were killed Thursday when mortars tore through the city's main shopping market. Another 40 people were injured. Ethiopian Somali government troops have been implicated in several bombing attacks on civilian areas over the last year. The conflict in Somalia is widely considered Africa's worst humanitarian crisis. An estimated 6,000 people have been killed, hundreds of thousands displaced in the clash between U.S.-backed Ethiopian forces and Somali fighters. A U.S. delegation is trying to win Russian backing this week for the Bush administration's controversial plans for a missile system in Eastern Europe. The U.S. wants to host the bases in Poland and the Czech Republic. The White House continues to insist the system is needed as protection against Iran, despite last week's own conclusion from U.S. intelligence that Iran has abandoned its nuclear weapons program. In Budapest, acting Undersecretary of State John Rood said Iran's threat is growing.
We have seen a large growth in the missile capabilities of countries like North Korea and Iran in recent years. This is a threat that we think is real and growing, and one that it is prudent to take steps to deter and to defend against through means like missile defense.
The Bush administration has already launched talks aimed at a settlement with North Korea. Critics of the missile system call it a first-strike option for the United States. The International Committee of the Red Cross has issued a rare policy statement criticizing Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In a new report, the Red Cross says the Israeli government is denying millions of Palestinians their human dignity. The Red Cross cites Israel's continued system of closures, settlements, checkpoints, bulldozings, and military attacks. Three Palestinians were killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza on Thursday. Argentina is rejecting U.S. accusations of a Venezuelan plot to influence its elections. Four people were arrested in Miami this week on charges of trying to funnel hundreds of thousands of dollars to Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. She was elected in October to succeed her husband, Néstor Kirchner. On Thursday, Fernandez dismissed the allegations and accused the U.S. of interference in Argentine affairs.
Argentina. Argentina never needs someone telling us who our friends are, just as we never tell other countries who their friends should be. We have a strong conviction in the autodetermination of nations.
Esta presidenta puede ser mujer, pero no se va a dejar presionar.
This president may be a woman, but she is not going to let herself be pressured. I will continue firming our relations with all of the friendly nations of Latin America.
Con todos los países latinoamericanos de amistad,
and with the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela.
Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner began her term on Monday. The four Miami suspects have been charged with failing to register as agents of the Venezuelan government. The Bush administration has been handed another defeat in its efforts to prosecute suspects accused of plotting terror attacks in the United States. A Miami jury has acquitted one of the seven Miami men accused of planning to blow up Chicago's Sears Tower. A mistrial was declared for the other six defendants after the jury deadlocked. The case had appeared to rest entirely on one suspect's conversation with an FBI informant posing as an al-Qaeda representative. The FBI later described the alleged plot as aspirational rather than operational. In New Jersey, lawmakers have approved a measure to abolish executions in the state. Democratic Governor John Corzine has said he will approve the measure next week. This will make New Jersey the first state in the United States to abolish the death penalty in 40 years. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. The Justice Department has announced the FBI is investigating the top official overseeing corruption and abuse in the U.S.-led reconstruction of Iraq. Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction Stuart Bowen is under suspicion for a series of improprieties, including tampering with employee emails. Bowen's investigations have indicted several American officials on corruption charges, documented wasteful and inept work by large contractors, and found the Pentagon did not properly track hundreds of thousands of weapons given to Iraqi troops. The Bush administration tried to close down his office last year, but backed off following congressional opposition. And in Iowa, Democratic presidential candidates held their final debate of the year before the Iowa caucus Thursday, just weeks before the vote. Congressmember Dennis Kucinich was excluded despite having the same polling numbers as three other candidates, both nationally and locally in Iowa. Also excluded was former Senator Mike Gravel, in what can only be described as a campaign first. Gravel has released a rap video criticizing his exclusion. The song samples John Lennon and Yoko Ono's song, Give Peace a Chance.
Yeah. Everybody talking about politician, nepotism, patriotism, jingoism, phony patriotism is jingoism. Why won't you let me say what I want to say? Power to the people. Give peace a chance. Everybody talking about fascism, militarism, fanaticism, terrorism, despotism, fear, Islamofascism, American imperialism, harm's way. Why won't you let me say what I want to say? Power to the people. Give peace a chance. Everybody talking about pollution, solution, revolution, evolution, revolution, freedom of speech, freedom to be who you are, the Constitution. Why won't you let me say what I want to say? Power to the people. Give peace a chance. Power to the people. Give peace a chance. Everybody talking about corporate censorship, party censorship, partisan censorship. Why are they afraid of the truth? Ripped off. Why won't you let me say what I want to say? Power to the people. Give peace a chance. Power to the people.
Yes, that's former Alaska Senator and Democratic presidential hopeful Mike Gravel performing his new version of Give Peace a Chance. And a correction only for our TV viewers, that congressional contempt of Congress for Karl Rove and Josh Bolten, the current chief of staff, we showed an image of John Bolton before, the former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. It's Josh Bolton, the chief of staff, and Karl Rove. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thursday's being described by some as one of the darkest days in baseball history, following the publication of an official Major League Baseball report on the widespread use of steroids and performance-enhancing drugs in the sport. About 90 retired and current players were named in the report, including some of the game's biggest superstars, such as New York Yankees pitcher Roger Clemens, San Francisco Giants slugger Barry Bonds. Former Senator George Mitchell headed the 20-month investigation.
The evidence we uncovered indicates that this has not been an isolated problem involving just a few players or a few clubs. Many players were involved. Each of the 30 clubs has had players who have been involved with such substances at some time in their careers. The minority of players who used such substances were wrong. They violated federal law and baseball policy, and they distorted the fairness of competition by trying to gain an unfair advantage over the majority of players who followed the law and the rules. They, the players who follow the law and the rules, are faced with the painful choice of either being placed at a competitive disadvantage or becoming illegal users themselves. No one should have to make that choice.
George Mitchell said the problem of steroids in sports extends far beyond professional baseball teams. He estimated hundreds of thousands of high school students currently use steroids. Sports writer Dave Zirin joins us in Washington, D.C. He's author of the new book, Welcome to the Terror Dome, The Pain, the Politics, and Promise of Sports, a regular contributor to The Nation magazine, and writes a weekly column called Edge of Sports. Denise Garibaldi also joins us on the phone from California. 5 years ago, her 24-year-old son, Rob Garibaldi, committed suicide after suffering from anabolic steroid-induced depression. Denise has become a vocal critic of steroid use, testified before Congress, and serves on the board of advisors of the Taylor Hooten Foundation, which fights steroid abuse. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Dave Zirin, let's begin with you. Summarize what you learned yesterday.
Well, what I learned was that the Mitchell report is, what I would argue, a breathtaking fraud. I mean, this is a report that took 20 months, cost $20 million, and at the end of the day, 90 players' names were named, and yet George Mitchell did not touch upper management, he did not touch ownership, and we're left to believe that steroids in baseball was something that occurred in the locker room, independent of the knowledge of upper management. And this is the narrative that we've been served up over the last 10 years, and it just does not hold water. Mitchell let the owners skate. And this is the problem with having George Mitchell at the front of this report. George Mitchell is on the board of directors of the Boston Red Sox. He is on the board of directors of the Walt Disney Company, which owns ESPN, which is the number one broadcast partner of Major League Baseball. I mean, this is like having Dick Cheney head up an alternative energy conference. It just doesn't hold water, and to me, it stains the entire report.
Dave Zirin, explain the responsibility of the owners. What have they gained?
Well, I could tell you what they gained with two numbers here. One is $500 million, the other is $2.4 billion. $500 million is what the owners sold the rights of Major League Baseball to after the 1994 strike, which canceled the World Series. $2.4 billion is what they sold just the playoff rights to a decade later. And in that decade, what you saw was an unbelievable surge in home runs. I mean, it's like the insanely sexist Nike slogan, "Chicks dig the long ball." That became the slogan for Major League Baseball over the course of that decade. And this juicing of the game, this increasing of power in the game, was something that occurred on numerous fronts. I mean, stadiums became smaller, the bats were made with a different kind of wood, the strike zone shrunk, and we're supposed to believe that Major League owners perpetuated all of these things, yet turned their back and just whistled when it came to what players were actually ingesting and putting in their bodies. I mean, the Mitchell report is an expose of trainers and of clubhouse attendance and players, and it paints this picture of just sort of a benign neglect on behalf of owners. As Mitchell said, they were just slow to act. And that, to me, really does let them off the hook, and it doesn't get us at the root of the problem.
Dave, what role do you think race has played in all of this? For years, the media has focused on Barry Bonds and his possible steroid use. Barry Bonds is African-American. Roger Clemens is white. It was a shock to many when his name came up yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I've described the Mitchell report as all sizzle and no steak. The sizzle is naming Roger Clemens, seven-time Cy Young Award winner, perhaps the greatest right-handed pitcher to ever put on a uniform. And for years, some of us, you know, a vocal minority has said, why is it we talk about Barry Bonds, we drag his name through the mud, but we never talk about Roger Clemens? Because their similarities are very profound. I mean, both of them had huge career upsurges into their late 30s and early 40s. Both of them are incredibly moody when it comes to dealing with the press. And yet with Barry Bonds, the assumption has always been one of guilt. And with Roger Clemens, there's been this picture painted as if he's somebody who just, you know, drinks a big glass of vitamin D milk, says his prayers, eats his vitamins, and goes out there and wins Cy Youngs into his 40s. And as one national columnist said yesterday after Clemens' name was named, he said, you know what, I look at Clemens and I look at Bonds, and the only difference is the color of their skin. So I think Clemens, I mean, it's a breathtaking example of media hypocrisy when it comes to race and steroids.
Dave Zirin, of course, Roger Clemens' attorney says he denies all of this, that it's a lie.
Well, yeah, and I think actually Roger Clemens himself, I think, is going to need to step forward and say that himself, because the evidence against him is rather damning. But I will say this in Roger Clemens' defense and in defense of everybody who's named in the Mitchell report. I mean, this is not holy writ. This wasn't a court of law. Only two major league players even spoke to current major league players even spoke to George Mitchell. The evidence he has is because a clubhouse attendant for the Mets and a personal trainer for the Yankees both were cutting a deal with the federal government. And that's what really gave Mitchell the guts of the report in terms of canceled checks, in terms of naming the names of Roger Clemens and Andy Pettit, the two Yankee pitchers, which has certainly been the big sizzle in this story. And I think we have to realize that people never got the chance to face their accusers. People were not able to offer counter evidence to this. And what you're going to see now is a grievance procedure and a line of protest that is going to be going on for months and is going to make the idea of just sitting back and enjoying the games very difficult for a lot of people.
We're talking to sports writer Dave Zirin. We'll also be joined by a mom who lost her son to steroid abuse. Stay with us.
Called to see if she'd like to go to see a show, but Miss Kate said no. I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I ever get back, 'cause it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame, 'cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Katie Casey saw all the games, knew all the players by their first names, told the umpire he was wrong all along, and she was strong. When the score was 2-2, Katie Casey, she had the clue.
Carly Simon singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and for TV viewers, that is, the person who was dancing to that music is a traffic cop in Rhode Island in Providence called Tony Lepore. For our radio listeners, you can go to our website and see the scene. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're talking about baseball's Hall of Shame. I want to turn back to former Senator George Mitchell's press conference Thursday. This is what he had to say about the use of steroids by high school athletes.
The illegal use of these substances to improve athletic performance may cause serious harm to the user. Apart from the dangers posed to the major league player himself, however, his use of these substances encourages young athletes to use them. Because adolescents are already subject to significant hormonal changes, the abuse of steroids and other substances can have more serious effects on them than they have on adults. Many young Americans are placing themselves at risk. Some estimates appear to show a recent decline in steroid use by high school students. That's heartening, but the range of estimates is from about 3 to 6%. And even the lower figure means that hundreds of thousands of high school-aged young people are illegally using steroids. It's important to deal with the players who are illegal users. But it's at least as important, perhaps even more so, to be concerned about the reality that hundreds of thousands of our children are using them. Every American, not just baseball fans, ought to be shocked into action by that disturbing truth. I'd like to recognize Don Hooten, who's here today. He established the Taylor Hooten Foundation for fighting steroid abuse after his son took his own life after abusing anabolic steroids. In a congressional hearing in 2005, Don said, and I quote, "Our youngsters hear the message loud and clear, and it's wrong. If you would want to achieve your goal, it's okay to use steroids to get you there because the pros are doing it. It's a real challenge for parents to overpower the strong message that's being sent to our children by your behavior.
That's former Senator George Mitchell at the news conference yesterday on steroid abuse by the top baseball players. Denise Garibaldi joins Dave Zirin now. Denise lost her son, Rob. He committed suicide in 2002 after suffering from anabolic steroid-induced depression and testified before Congress. Denise, tell us about Rob. How did he start using steroids?
Rob started using steroids when he was a young man. He had started college and was told by professional scouts that had been following him for many years that he needed to get bigger, that there was nothing else in the game, in his game, that needed to improve, except he needed to gain weight. After years of a really good work ethic and nutrition, he chose what he thought the only thing he could do was to do what he believed all other baseball players were doing, or most of them, and that was to use anabolic steroids. They did what they promised. Rob put on that weight. He went on to play for the University of Southern California. He was drafted by the New York Yankees in 1999, but he then went on to suffer for 18 months before his death.
How did he get the steroids?
We know his initial use came from a trip across to Tijuana, Mexico. And what is so shocking about that is within 1 hour's time, he was able to meet a doctor, get a prescription, get all the paraphernalia, fill the prescription, and be back across the border. After that, he was provided them by trainers, and he also used the internet.
Did you realize what was happening at the end of Rob's life, just before he committed suicide? How did his personality change?
Rob's whole personhood changed, and we believe it was that awareness, in addition to how steroids destroyed his ability to play baseball, that caused his decision to take his own life.
Barry Bonds, his role in your son's life, his image?
Rob loved Barry Bonds. He loved Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco. He was about 9 years old, living in the Bay Area in California, when the Bash Brothers came across and just totally entertained the baseball world. And he spent years simulating Barry Bonds' swing. And growing up where Barry Bonds grew up, he just felt very much an affinity for him and respected him as a player. And unfortunately, Rob realized that Barry and Mark had begun cheating and really thought that it was something he was going to have to do in order to compete at that level.
Denise, how typical is this?
It's more typical than anyone would like to believe. We now know about 5 million children in the United States have taken the course Rob has felt he's needed to take. And the problem is also escalates when we now think of young girls also using for the purpose of having that more beautiful, chiseled body. And even though the latest reports say that steroid use is down, we are so concerned that other substances are being developed as we speak, and that this issue of performance-enhancing substances is not going to go away, not for a very, very long time. Hmm.
Your son's psychiatrist, talk about his findings with Rob's rage and its relation to the steroid injections.
You know, it took Rob a number of years to actually talk about his steroid use. He never thought of it as being a drug. He never thought of it as causing any harm. When he first became ill, when he was at the University of Southern California, he had a mental collapse, and we really thought it was a bipolar episode. And when he went to the psychiatrist, that was, they talked about symptoms. But at that point, even though the question was asked, Rob denied his use. So Rob was actually treated for symptoms, but for the wrong disorder. It really took a few roid rages in which he choked his father, threw him to the ground, and had to be pulled off by his older brother at great effort for Rob and anyone to really see what was going on. And it wasn't until he had a psychiatric hospitalization in which he was held involuntarily for about 5 days that he realized that steroids were indeed the problem and the truth came out.
Dave Zirin, I want to ask him about this in the broader picture, but Denise, you mentioned women, and I can't help thinking, but Marion Jones, whose records have now been wiped from the books this week, who admitted she used steroids.
She's just one of many. I mean, we need to go all the way back to the 60s when the East German swimmers in the Olympics were thought to be phenomenal, and we looked at that body shape and type and knew that there was something going on. And here our governor here in California also admits to using, but when they were using it was not considered illegal. And the travesty of all of this is that even though steroids were not a banned substance in the league, that they were always an illegal substance. And I have never understood why we have held professional sports above the law.
What now do you think has to be done, Denise, for other young people in this country?
Unfortunately, I think George Mitchell really missed an important part in not offering some kind of sanctions, disciplinary sanctions against the players that were named yesterday. I'm not talking about fines or jail time or prosecution. I'm talking about having them feel the consequences in such that they would have made really wonderful spokespeople about support performance-enhancing substances. We could really use them in our education efforts, and children, no matter what, are going to look up to them as role models, and the best role models we can have are those people that admit their mistakes and try to right them. And I wish kids would be asking to have their baseball signed by people who can now say they live and play baseball with integrity.
And Denise, your advice to parents, what to look for?
Oh, to look for rapid weight gain, muscle mass in the shoulders, significant acne, which is so typical in adolescents, but look for it on their back and shoulders. It can really become something quite ugly. Swollen face, and then, of course, look at any signs of depression, mood changes, roid rages, and delusions. These kids become quite self-centered, narcissistic, and their thinking patterns get very distorted along with erratic behavior. It's really important for them to talk about this frequently with their children as much as they would maybe talk to them about sexual interactions. And kids will get tired of listening, but they will listen and hopefully make the right decision.
Denise Garibaldi, I want to thank you for being with us and being so brave as to speak out. Denise's son, Rob, committed suicide in 2002 after suffering from anabolic steroid-induced depression. She's testified before Congress on steroids and has served on the board of advisors to the Taylor Hutton Foundation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we turn now to the last Democratic debate, it's just weeks before the Iowa caucuses, January 3rd. The last debate in Iowa took place on Thursday, organized by the Iowa newspaper, the Des Moines Register, and included only six candidates. Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel were not invited. Although none of the candidates attacked each other, there were some sharp questions from the host, Carolyn Washburn, to each of the candidates, beginning with Senator Hillary Clinton.
Senator Clinton, during your time as First Lady, there were criticisms that your process to develop your health care plan was too closed and secretive. Some Iowans we hear from are worried that your presidency would operate the same way. As president, how would you ensure that your administration doesn't withhold information from the public, even if it gave ammunition to your critics?
Well, I learned a lot from that experience, and clearly one of the principal lessons is that you have to have a very strong communication strategy, and we didn't do that. And I have certainly learned from that during the remaining years in the White House when I helped to create the Children's Health Insurance Program and did a lot of other work with the Clinton administration and, of course, now in the Senate. I want to have an open and transparent government. I have put forth very specific plans for how I would reform the government, put as much as we can on the Internet. Now we've got this tool, let's use it. Let's have as much sunlight as we possibly can gather. Let's also make sure that we have an administration that works with the Congress instead of stonewalling and denying legitimate requests for information and witness testimony and all the rest that this administration unfortunately has done. I think it's also very important that we end the revolving door of lobbyists, that we move toward public financing. I've signed on to Russ Feingold's bill because I think it is the best piece of legislation to try to make those changes. So I'm very committed to open, transparent government, and I've learned a lot, and I think I can apply those lessons.
Thank you. Senator Biden, you and your campaign have had a number of occasions to correct or clarify things you've said relating to race, including your remarks about Senator Obama being, quote, clean and articulate, your comment about Indians working at 7-Eleven, and recently to the Washington Post, in which you spoke about race while describing disparities between schools in Washington, D.C. and Iowa. Do these gaffes or misunderstandings, or however you would characterize them, indicate you're uncomfortable talking about race, or are people just being too sensitive?
I think that I have my whole career. I got involved in public policy. I got involved in politics because of the civil rights movement. It's the overwhelming core of my support in my home state. I get the overwhelming majority, over 95% of the vote of minorities in my state. I may have phrased those things wrongly, but when I talked about the Indian population, what I was making the point was they're building families. They're coming by businesses, 7-Elevens and Dunkin' Donuts and small shops, just like those Italian immigrants used to do, and they're building families. The point I was making about the inner city of Washington is the point that Barack just made. Barack made the point, he said that minorities start off at a disadvantage. They start off with a gap, an achievement gap that exists before they even walk into school, minorities. And so I was making the same point. It may be possible because I speak so bluntly that people misunderstand, but no one who knows me in my state, no one who I've worked with in the United States Congress has ever wondered about my commitment to civil rights and civil liberties. And if you take a look at my record as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, of the Judiciary Committee, ranking member, chairman for 16 years, starting with the Voting Rights Act and worked its way through to voting against constitutional amendments on busing when busing was taking place in my state. My credentials are as good as anyone who's ever run for president of the United States on civil rights.
I just want to make the comment. I've worked with Joe Biden. I've seen his leadership. I have absolutely no doubt about what is in his heart and the commitment that he's made with respect to racial equality in this country. So I will provide some testimony, as they say in church, that Joe is on the right side of the issues and is fighting every day for a better America.
Thank you. Senator Edwards, you've talked a lot about reducing the power of wealth and special interests in the country. The same groups often responsible for getting things done in Washington, too. How will you accomplish your agenda after spending a lot of months calling these groups corrupt?
Well, here's what I believe. What I believe is that there are very well-financed insurance companies, drug companies, oil companies. Some people argue that we're going to sit at a table with these people and they're going to voluntarily give their power away. I think it is a complete fantasy. It will never happen. I don't think anybody in America wants to see politicians fighting with each other. But I think they understand that we have an epic battle in front of us to do what needs to be done for all the American people. All the things that we've talked about today, health care, attacking global warming, doing something about a tax policy that favors big corporations and the richest Americans, doing something about our trade policy, every single one of those things depends on winning this battle. We cannot do it if we don't win this battle. And all I would say is I've been fighting these people, big corporations, for 20 years in courtrooms and then in public life. I have been fighting them my entire life, and I have been winning my entire life. And if you want a fighter, to voters, to caucus goers, you are looking at somebody, I'm 54 years old, who has spent his entire life engaged in this fight and winning this fight that we must win to be able to do the things that we want to do for this country.
Thank you. Senator Dodd, you write in your book that you still struggle with the memories of when your father, former Senator Thomas Dodd, was censured by the Senate in 1967 for alleged misuse of campaign money. How much are you motivated in your run for president by a desire to restore the Dodd family name that was hurt by the censure?
I'm motivated by my family because of their public service. About a week or two before my father passed away, some 40 years ago, he was asked by a reporter, Carolyn, if he'd do it all over again in light of his lost election and what had happened to him. I'll never forget sitting in the room and hearing his answer that day. He said he'd do it again in a minute. But he started the first National Youth Administration in my home state of Connecticut in 1933 as part of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. He said there's no other calling in life where you can do as much for as many people as you can through public service. Lawyers only have so many clients, doctors only so many patients, but a well-intentioned public servant can make a difference in the lives of millions of people. That's my motivation. I want to carry that tradition on. That's why I'm running for president.
Senator Obama, you have Bill Clinton's former national security advisor, State Department policy director, and Navy secretary, among others, advising you. With relatively little foreign policy experience of your own, how will you rely on so many Clinton advisors and still deliver the kind of break from the past that you're promising voters?
Well,
I want to hear that.
Well, Hillary, I'm looking forward to you advising me as well. I want to gather up talent from everywhere. We haven't talked too much about the war, but one of the points that I've tried to make during the course of this year, during the campaign, is I want to change the mindset that got us into war. And because I think that since 9/11, we've had a president who essentially fed us a politics of fear and distorted our foreign policy in profound ways. And I think that there are a lot of good people in the Clinton years, the Carter years, George Bush won, who understand that our military power is just one component of our power. And I revere what our military does. And I will do whatever it takes as Commander-in-Chief to keep the American people safe. But I know that part of making us safe is restoring our respect in the world. And I think those who are advising me agree with that. And part of the agenda that we're putting forward in terms of talking not just to our friends but also to our enemies, initiating contacts with Muslim leaders around the world, doubling our efforts in terms of foreign aid, all those are designed to create long-term security by creating long-term prosperity around the world.
Governor Richardson, you promote your experience as Energy Secretary among your credentials. During that time, though, there were serious questions about lax security at the country's national labs, allegations that scientist Wenho Li breached security at Los Alamos. You told Tim Russert in May, we had some issues with the nuclear secrets issue and Wenho Li, but I think on the whole, I was a good energy secretary. In this era when Americans are fearful about our national security, talk about that part of your resume.
Well, and I will add that in 25 years in public service, there are probably many more other mistakes that I've made. But I want to say to you that when it was with Wenho Li, this was the issue of protecting our nuclear secrets. And he did plead guilty. I do feel that he was incarcerated in solitary confinement. This was wrong. I tried to change it, but I didn't work hard enough. The point is that we do have in all of our lives, and as a congressman, as a UN ambassador, as a candidate, I've made a lot of gaffes, and I'm glad you didn't raise them. You know, I'll stand behind my record as Energy Secretary. I brought compensation to workers that had beryllium and other contamination. I brought forth a renewable portfolio standard, the first one that says electricity has to be renewable in this country. We made air conditioning 30% more energy efficient. There's some cases in the Wenho Lee where I wish I'd been stronger, but I don't apologize for trying to protect our nuclear secrets, and we should have done a lot more.
Thank you.
Some of Thursday's Democratic presidential debate. That clip ended with New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson admitting he made some mistakes in the handling of the case of Wenho Lee, who was the nuclear scientist at Los Alamos of Chinese descent, falsely accused by the Clinton administration of spying for the Chinese government. As President Clinton's energy secretary, Bill Richardson fired Wenho Lee, who was then arrested, indicted on 59 counts, threatened with execution. He was held for 278 days in solitary confinement. Within a year, the government dropped 58 of the 59 charges. And a federal judge then ordered Wenho Lee's release. In an unusual statement from the bench, he rebuked the government, apologized to Wenho Lee. Last year, the government agreed to pay him nearly $900,000 for violating his right to privacy by leaking information to the press. When we interviewed Governor Richardson in September 2005 in Santa Fe, he was far less conciliatory about his handling of Wenho Lee's case. I spoke with Governor Richardson at a studio in Santa Fe, New Mexico. At that time, he said, quote, he stands by everything he said and did in the case.
This was a man that was convicted on several counts of tampering with classified information. So,
but the minorest of counts. I mean, what he was originally.
Well, no, it was not minor. This is where you're wrong. It was not minor. There were very sensitive nuclear secrets that possibly were compromised and were improperly taken from his computer. Now, the judgment of the judge, I believe, is speculative, but I stand behind the very strong actions that I took to protect our nuclear secrets.
So you say the federal judge is wrong in saying that you're the problem?
Absolutely.
The
He's
leaks.
Totally wrong.
Uh-huh. I mean, in the case of Wenho Lee, though, originally they said he could be a reason for the possible, like President Bush used in the argument for the Iraq War. He could be the source of a nuclear explosion, a bombing of the United States. And ultimately, when the judge freed Wenho Lee, he said he had been egregiously misled by government officials about what Wenho Lee was responsible for. And he was irate. He was enraged. The judge, I mean.
Well, that's his opinion. I believe that we acted properly in safeguarding our nuclear secrets. He was convicted on several counts. There were some mistakes in that case. It involved the entire federal government. And I stand behind everything that I did.
Governor Bill Richardson, that was September 2005. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back from break, we go to New Jersey, which has just had a historic vote against the death penalty. Stay with us.
I'm right to call us out. I'm returning it with arms. I may not make it back. This I'm sending to my moms. Faith is depleting because my people are bleeding and my people are needing because history is repeating and my eyes are seeing brothers hanging from an oak. Intravenously, dense breaths are starting to get short. Well, my way is just a redeeming form of justice. So how come when I look upon these cells, I see just us? Must trust in God like the dollar bill. The U.S. Mint keeps our eyes tint off Capitol Hill like Amityville. I'm gonna haunt that house till this racially biased penalty is denounced and announced all the travesties to man. And up in my mail comes the deeds to our land. And the revolution is broadcasting hysteria, plus the welfare poets playing resistance on the radio.
Most of us cannot afford to hire an attorney. I'm poor, so there's a higher chance that they gon' murder me. The murder rates are low in space without the penalty. Juveniles are mentally ill on the penalty. The penalty is racist. That's the penalty. We can't keep justifying murder.
Call for Hassan by the Welfare Poets here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In New Jersey, a historic vote against the death penalty. Lawmakers voted 44-36 Thursday to abolish executions in the state. New Jersey's Democratic Governor John Corzine said he will approve the measure next week. This will make New Jersey the first state in the United States to abolish the death penalty in 40 years. The repeal follows the recommendation from a state commission report that the death penalty was expensive, did not have a deterrent effect, and risked killing an innocent person. It described the death penalty as, quote, inconsistent with evolving standards of decency. New Jersey will now replace the death penalty with a sentence of life without parole. The decision comes at a time when the U.S. Supreme Court is taking up the question of whether lethal injection violates the constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Lethal injection, the most frequently used method of performing executions. Laurie Post joins us now, an organizer with New Jerseyans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. He founded the group in 1999 to honor his daughter, who was murdered in Georgia in 1988. He's a retired legal aid attorney. He's just been named the director of Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. Laurie Post joining us from Philadelphia. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Were you in Trenton yesterday when the vote came down?
Oh, I certainly was. I was there and thrilled by the outcome, as you might expect, after working for all these years on this subject that I think is so doggone important.
Why do you feel it is so important? And tell us your own story about the loss of your daughter.
Well, yeah, I'll start with that. My daughter was murdered. It was domestic violence 19 years ago. Her killer, her husband, received a 20-year sentence. I was, as my wife describes me, a zombie for the next 10 years, sitting around waiting to die. And then one day, about 9 years ago or so, I took up this topic because I was trying to save the life. I was asked, as an activist, a legal aid lawyer, someone asked me to save the life, try to save the life of a Pedro Medina in the state of Florida. But we worked to save Pedro's life and had His Holiness the Pope send a letter to the governor of Florida. But in the long run, we failed. He was executed and his head was set on fire. And my wife and I said, you know, what is this about justice where one
explain, Laurie Post, what you mean by his head was set on fire.
It was a botched execution. Florida, three times with the electric chair, botched executions. And Pedro was one of them. And they set his head on fire, as simple as that, or as horrible as that, I should say. And we thought, why does one man who kills, stabs a woman to death, that woman happened to be our daughter, why does he get 20-year sentence, and another man who stabs a woman to death, his next-door neighbor, why does he get executed by us as citizens of this country and has his head set on fire? From that moment on, I became alive. I took up this cause with some others. And now in New Jersey, we've grown to a 12,000-person organization of, I would like to say, a well-oiled machine. But we're not that. We're just a bunch of volunteers,
Well, you certainly succeeded. In fact, in your core group, there are others like you who've lost their children or loved ones who were murdered and yet are standing up now against the death penalty in New Jersey. Explain how you organized to accomplish this. The governor says he's going to sign this next week. It's going to end the death penalty in New Jersey, first time in a state in this country in 40 years.
Yeah, I'll explain that. But you made a point about, yes, victims' family members. I don't want to miss saying this. We started out, it was just my wife and myself, and for a couple of years, we were the only victim family members, and kind of a little bit felt like freaks. The common wisdom was that if you lost a family member, especially a child, to murder, you would want that person killed. So we thought, standing alone, then I found this organization, Murder, I wasn't the founder, it was there, and we joined it. Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, where people felt that way. And then since, against the death penalty, and then from that day to this day, There are now 62 of us in New Jersey, 62 that have joined up, and we didn't recruit them or anything. And we all signed a letter to the legislature and the governor saying we want this abomination of the death penalty ended. And your question about organizing, Amy, it was just hit or miss at the beginning. Wherever two or more people would gather, I would be there if they'd invite me. Mostly churches, synagogues, schoolrooms, Rotary, whoever would hear me. Many times agreeing, many times in opposition. I debated on television and radio, others who felt differently than I did, and it just grew from there, and mostly from religious faith groups were our greatest ally, clergy and folks from churches and synagogues who would join our group, and it just kept growing.
Were you particularly surprised by anyone or any group that joined you? Not at the beginning, perhaps a group that fought you or a person who did, but then came around?
Yeah, and this is something I personally didn't have too much to do with, but law enforcement. You expect law enforcement, and I have to be honest, I would say probably the majority of law enforcement might be on the other side, but maybe a very strong and vocal minority felt, as we do, that this is wrong. This is the wrong kind of punishment. That we want full punishment for people, but we want to lock them away. We don't want to kill them. And that's the argument I've made. Others make different arguments, but we become like the killers ourselves if we coldly calculate it. Deliberately kill someone as a people, we diminish ourselves as people, especially in this great nation. We shouldn't be about killing people unless absolutely necessary. And absolutely necessary is only, in my mind, is only self-defense or defense of others.
Laurie, has this lessened your pain at all?
I would say yes. People applaud me for going out and doing this and saying, I don't know how you can do it. Well, there's this selfish motivation as well as trying to do a good deed, and that is that it's been tremendous therapy for me. I do this work, and I think of Lisa. I have her with me all the time. When I was a legal aid lawyer, you mentioned earlier, she was proud of the work I did for racial justice, for economic justice, what little I could do. And I know she's proud of me right now. So it certainly lessens my pain. And I was just talking to my wife about that the other day and saying, you know, I started to cry more lately, like the old days I cried so much. And I couldn't understand why. And it suddenly struck me that if this situation is ending, I feel somehow, you know, might be going a little bit away from her, but recently I was selected to be the director of that Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation organization, so I'll still be doing this, so Lisa will still be with me.
Laurie Post, thanks so much for joining us and having the courage to act. Laurie Post, founder of New Jerseyans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you so much. As we wrap up now, we end today's show by going back 30 years to 1977, to the founding of Pacifica radio station WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. This weekend, Saturday night at the Washington Convention Center, celebrating those 30 years with Harry Belafonte and Sonny Rollins and Dorothy Height, Dick Gregory, among many. WPFW considered the only jazz and justice station in the nation's capital. We go back to the first hour of WPFW in 77.
WPFW, Pacifica, 89.3 FM. Welcome to WPFW, Pacifica, Washington, finally on the air after a 9-year struggle. This is Denise Oliver, program director of PFW, and we have a lot of people who are going to be coming through here tonight.
Hard to hear, but not hard to celebrate. WPFW, now 30 years old. I look forward to seeing people at the Washington Convention Center on Saturday night. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, as well as Aaron Mattei, Angelique Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman. Special happy birthday to Nicole Salazar. Thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.